irresponsible, inexperienced, naive. These are words that are sometimes used to describe teenagers in our society. It's not uncommon for people to associate teenagers with crime, drugs, and alcohol. But are these associations justified? Are our beliefs based on reality? Or do these low expectations we have of adolescents actually help to perpetuate the role that they see for themselves? Today, on the Health Justice Radio Collective, we'll be speaking with Dr. Jean Clinton, an associate clinical professor in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Neuroscience at McMaster University. She has been a consultant on child welfare and children's mental health programs for 25 years. Some of her work specializes on the adolescent brain, and she strives to educate the public about some misconceptions that we may have about the way teenagers think and behave.
You're listening to Health Justice Radio Collective on CFMU 93.3.
Welcome to the show, Dr. Clinton, and thanks for being with us today.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for the invitation. I'm happy to be here.
Oh, we're happy to have you.
Yeah.
So just starting from the beginning, I guess, can you please describe to us how we define adolescence and the period?
Yeah, it's a great question because it's not all cultures have this period that we call adolescence. And technically, it's the period of childhood when you need adult supervision, and then the period between that and taking on adult roles, having children in our society, getting a job, taking on a house, et cetera, et cetera. So that period used to be pretty well lined up between your biological development mm-hmm. and your social, sexual, and psychological development. You know, you'd have puberty, and then within a shorter period of time, you would take on the adult role of raising a family. But now that period of adolescence has gone from first period, age 9, 10, mm-hmm. First baby is about 29. Mm-hmm. So we've got this very, very long period of time, and it is that period in between childhood and taking on adult roles.
Okay. So I guess this period of time, you're saying it's changed kind of over the past generation?
The past number of generations. But the change is from a big sociological change. Mm-hmm. So biologically, there hasn't necessarily been changes since the 50s, 1900s, to know that we necessarily know about, but certainly the social expectations, but even more importantly, the social structures surrounding teenagers, the expectations, the support, the leading into adulthood mm-hmm. has changed dramatically. Mm-hmm. You know, we used to see people, Alexander the Great was 16. I met a family doctor, you know, when he took Alexander, when he went on his first crusade, mm-hmm. I met a family doctor who was 17, joined the merchant navy and was a captain at 19. Well, that was in those days. He's 70 now. The social construct is very, very different. So it's not that kids have created this longer period of in between, mm-hmm. but that society and expectations and jobs for kids have changed very dramatically.
Right. So what do you think are some of the implications of this extended period of adolescence that we have now?
Well, I think that there are some There are some societal implications. We know from as far back as Plato that there's always been this kind of tension between the between adults and this in-between period. You know, Plato, 300 BC, talked about it. But what we are now seeing is that we know more about changes that happen in the teenage brain from neuroscience. We're able to image changes in the brain in ways we couldn't do before because they were too invasive. Mm-hmm. And now what we can see is that the brain is majorly under construction in these teen years, that the thrill-seeking, reward-seeking parts of the brain are developing and leading the charge, as it were, before the stop and think about it, the prefrontal cortex, the executive director, is developing. Mm-hmm. And so if you've got a societal situation where there is lots and lots of opportunity for thrill-seeking and reward-seeking, and less responsibility given and mentoring into adulthood, then you can start to understand why we see this as a time when injury and accidental death shoot through the roof. Now, in the 1920s, when you were 16, 17, and 18, you didn't have all of this free time. You were very quickly put into adult roles, mm-hmm. and that prefrontal cortex, those brain cells and connections would have been happening very, 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 very quickly. As well, there was less exposure to risk. So we've got this kind of mismatch and a dangerous combination that many people are worried about.
Okay, that's very interesting. So what you're saying is basically many years ago, you know, the brain of the young adolescent was still developing in the same way, but because of the different societal expectations, they were able to mature more quickly.
Mature more quickly, plus there was less exposure to risk. That's the hypothesis. We didn't have MRIs and other things that back then that we could have looked at, but that's the hypothesis. There's also there's this other very interesting field called evolutionary biology, mm-hmm. and to some the kind of message of that is that the in utero environment prepares for the external world. And so back in the 20s and 30s, the life expectancy was significantly shorter. So the need for brain maturation may have been, the genes early given the message to mature at this time rather than later. People wonder about that. We certainly know in young girls who don't have adult male figures in their life, they reach puberty earlier. And one of the evolutionary biological reasons explaining that is that they will need to have start having babies earlier so that more of them will survive in order to, keep the species going. So mm-hmm. it's a pretty interesting area.
Very interesting. So you spoke before about some of the changes that are occurring in the brain of an adolescent, and mm-hmm. you talked about kind of thrill-seeking and reward-seeking behaviors.
Yes.
Can you talk a bit more about how different parts of the brain kind of control different behaviors during adolescence?
Yeah, so we have different areas of our brain that the brain kind of matures in a hierarchical, from lower order functions up through emotional functions, and the last kind of areas to make connections are the kind of thinking cells. And we also know, and this was the news that's in the past 10 to 15 years, that the connections are also happening and changing around puberty, moving from the back of the brain to the front of the brain. And that means that brain cells that talk to each other, that connect and repeatedly, in the teen years, they get myelinated so that they can move and charge faster. The ones that don't get used get snipped away. So what the scientists are seeing is that the areas of the brain that are myelinating and maturing, the last areas are these prefrontal, the executive, organizing, planning, judgment, impulse inhibition. That's the last area to develop. So earlier development is the emotional system, the reward system. So that's why in a hot cognitive state, so, you know, when you're around your peers, that's why that emotional brain goes wham, and we see injury. But if that emotional brain hasn't been triggered, then kids are completely rational. They are completely responsible and, you know, are better creative thinkers than most adults can dream of being. They're not broken at all. But the challenge comes in when that emotional brain is activated, that kind of hot cognition. The connectivity there is under construction. And when teenagers in lab studies, they may know the risk of something, but they choose the reward, right? Those dopamine circuits are just reward circuits are being developed, and they select reward. Whereas, you know, once you're 35, you say, yeah, well, that sounds real good, but man, what's it going to cost me?
Yeah. So what determines the differences in terms of adolescence and whether they use their emotional brain to a great extent or whether they have more reason?
Oh, what a great question. And it's a million dollar question. You know, the first thing I should say, Ali, is that the majority of kids do really, really well, right? They, you know, they are not in trouble with the law. You know, you said in your intro about more crime. Our youth crime is going down. And in fact, it's less than 2% of youth who are involved in any kind of violent crime. And one of the big issues is that's not what you hear in the media, right? People think of this. So first of all, the majority of our adolescents are doing really well. And we've never had a generation that has done as much volunteering, as much connecting, has cared about so many issues, right? So that needs to be out there. This is a phenomenal, phenomenal generation. What is it, though, that makes some kids more at risk for risky behaviors? So we know about temperament, right? So there are some kids who are more more out there. They're more intense. They from younger ages, they've needed more of a bang, to get a thrill. So more extroverted, more higher surgency is what we call it. Those kids are to some degree a little more susceptible to risk-taking behavior. At the other end, we have kids who have experienced anxiety. And here they are. Adolescence is very confusing. You know, who do I fit in with? What's the right way to be? What do I want to do and be and look like when I'm older? So it's very, very confusing. And we see more mental health problems exhibiting themselves in adolescence. And so we're seeing a lot of kids using substance, using that risk in order to self-soothe. So as the brain is changing and modifying under construction in these areas, there are some kids who are at increased risk.
So you mentioned things like temperament, anxiety, maybe mental health. What about where an adolescent grows up or the environment that they grow up in? How can that
absolutely. A crucial concept. So if you, what you're busy doing in adolescence is building your brain, right? That's what, so if you are, if you're volunteering, you know, if you're planning on going to Botswana to volunteer and, you know, play sports, that's what's building your brain. But it also means that you're being surrounded by other kids. And you're being supported in your community to do those kinds of things. All of those increase your competencies and diminish your risk.
Right.
But if you are in an inner city where, because of our public policy, there's nothing for you to do, you're hanging around, you'd love to go to a basketball game, or you'd love to learn how to ollie on a skateboard, but you don't have access to that, mm-hmm. then that environment is going to make a big difference. So the physical environment makes a difference. The relational environment makes a huge difference. We know that when you've got an adult in your life who you have meals with on a regular basis, mm-hmm. you're going to do better than a child who is on their own. If mm-hmm. if you're in an environment where you can reach out for support, you're going to do better. But a lot of the young people that we see with mental health issues have a very desolate, lonely, non-connected life. And we are wired, our brain's a social organ, and those kids also are at greater risk.
Okay, so what kind of changes do you think need to happen within our society so that we can give more support to these adolescents who need it?
Yeah, so what can we do in our society to support? I think one of the very big things, and I think education is really examining this now, is as we're learning more about the brain, and we know that kids are captive in educational institutions until 17 or 18, mm-hmm. I think it's huge that schools look to more the development of connectivity and citizenship and how do you care, work with others, and get along with others. I think they need a much bigger focus on that, creating that civic community within the school, that with teachers and other students, that will be a huge protective factor.
Okay.
I think that we've been led down a fancy path about academic outcome mm-hmm. Equals good marks, equals stuffing the duck. And I think for many of our kids at risk, it's leaving them lost at school. So I think there's a huge issue that schools, and they're really, really addressing that in Ontario now. Student engagement and mm-hmm. student voice is a big move. I think the other thing at the societal level is we have to start speaking up and saying, you know what, I don't want to see all these stories that talk about one kid who did something bad when I've got 600 stories about kids who are doing amazing things. I think we have a responsibility to say, listen, come down and see where these MAC students are volunteering. Mm-hmm. Add up all of their information and you will see that the story and the picture of our young people is a heck of a lot better
mm-hmm.
allowing the media to portray. And then the other thing is let's change the picture of that parents are getting about what to expect as their kids go through the teen years. You know, it does not have to be there's an alien has invaded, as parents tell me that that's what they're worried about, but that this is a phenomenal, sure, it's worrisome because kids are exposed to more risk, but the conversations, the excitement, you never get as interested in a subject as big as you do in the teen years, again, mm-hmm. in your life in the same kind of a way. So we really need to say, listen, these are not kids at risk. These are kids at promise.
Mm-hmm.
And what can we do to shift this, put this on its head and say, teenagers rock. Adolescence is fantastic. And how can we support the healthy development? I think we just, you know, so from the school to the community to the family unit, we need to be changing the story.
Okay, so kind of all levels we need to address.
Yeah, and then when we look at the government as well, and again in Ontario, the Ministry of Children and Youth Services has just been exploring and has developed a youth policy framework. And just like we did in the early years, say, what does it take for all of our children under six to thrive? What does community need to do? What policy do we need to have? Our government, our ministry is saying, so now, what is it that we need for our children up to age actually 25 need in order to thrive? Because the brain is changing all the way to 25.
Yeah. So until now, there's been kind of more focus on early childhood development, do you think?
There has been Dr. Fraser Mustard, who was one of the deans of our medical school at McMaster here. He wrote a pivotal report in 1999 that really mobilized people around the early years and the importance of how the architecture of the brain is sculpted by that experience and affects life and health, learning, behavior. And so what the ministry and, you know, other people who are in youth serving agencies are saying, well, what can we put, why can't we have a document like that that will also bring together people to look at the, you know, the later years as well. And that way we can focus on strengthening communities for kids, earlier identification, and massive support.
Okay. And you were mentioning before about kind of the conceptions we have of adolescence in our society, and they're often negative.
Yes.
So do you think that's kind of the fault of the media for exposing negative stories, or where do you think those conceptions are coming from?
I think the media has a huge role to play, but the media listens to the public, so in some many ways we've allowed it to happen. But I think there has been a societal change that we haven't been paying enough attention to, that there have been changes as our economy goes down. Sociologists have noted that when the economy goes down, the view of adolescence goes down as well.
Oh.
Yeah. And when the economy is good, the adolescence goes up. And, you know, stopping and thinking about that, part of the reason is that when the economy is good, teenagers are out there, they're working, they're contributing, they're making lots of different connections. When the economy tanks, then teenagers lose their opportunity to work, lose their contribution to the home. So many things are a factor, and I just think that as a Canadian society, we don't stop and say often enough, how is what we're doing now going to affect the outcomes for our kids, and whether the outcomes are thriving or good mental health or whatever. We don't think about that. We think about are our roads working. We think about, you know, many things, but right up front, we don't have how are our children and young people doing.
Right.
And, you know, like our values-driven statements and questions are about how's the economy, how's healthcare. And until we start saying, how are our children, then I think we'll see this challenge. And that's all contributing. You know, I was at a full-day conference looking at the National Advisor on Health to the Prime Minister's report and what to do about it. So Dr. Kelly Leach did this report that showed that we're 20 of the richest 29 countries, we're 21 out of 29 in children's mental health.
Wow.
We're 22 out of 29 in accidental death and injury, and we're 27 out of 29 in childhood obesity.
Wow.
Well, who knows about that? Not nearly enough people. And I kind of think it's because we like childhood, the concept, but we don't really care enough about children.
Yeah.
You know, so I think it's multifactorial, and we really need to be saying we need to put children first. We need to be, as the UN Convention says, but we need to be rallying society around the reality that when our children do well, we all do well.
Yeah, I mean, they're the future, right, of our society and
our
outcomes.
Yeah, well, they're the present. They're the present as well, and the future. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. That's a great message. Thank you, Dr. Clinton.
You're very welcome.
And just as a last question, just for the public that's listening, what kind of access is there to adolescent mental health services in Hamilton for maybe teenagers that are struggling with some of these changes that are happening in their lives?
Right. So there are a number. One, the school system in Hamilton and across the province is working very, very hard. So if there was a teen struggling, know that the schools are trying to figure out and talk to somebody at school.
Okay.
Because the pathways are being developed that when teachers are being taught mental health literacy, not to become therapists, but to say, hey, listen, my connection to you counts, and I care about what's happening, and bring them down to the guidance or social worker.
Okay.
Then the mental health services are really rallying around to support teens. But the other very big thing is to talk to a family physician. You know, if you and your parents, talk to your parents, are concerned, see your family doctor, because again, many of the family doctor's offices now have social workers and psychiatrists and some child psychiatrists associated with them. But there's also a fabulous website called Mind Your Mind.
Mind Your Mind.
Mind Your Mind. If they go to that, there's lots and lots of information on for kids, for young people, about mental health, about where you can turn for help.
That's a wonderful message, Dr. Clinton. So thank you very, very much for being with us. And please take care and good luck with all your endeavors in the future.
Good. Okay, you too, Ellie.
Bye.
Bye.